Remaker's Mark Hidden Gems 1, The Man Who Would Be King. Hello everyone and welcome back to Remaker's Mark. Here we are in the first of our new Hidden Gems series with Andy's pick of The Man Who Would Be King. Before we talk about the film, just a quick little background about this new special series, special edition thingamajigger, I think is the technical term. Gerb. So Hidden Gems is very similar to our For Shame series, which we did, where for that series we went to the AFI 100 and looked at movies that are well-regarded, critically loved, that we had not seen, and we wanted to do that. So it was a good educational experience for us. This is similar to that, but it's not based on critics' picks, it's based on our picks. So we gathered up movies that we thought other people here have not likely seen, and we put together a little spreadsheet and picked, and we have five movies, each of us are picking one, that we are sharing as our hidden gem. So it just so happens that the person who shared it has seen it, and everyone else has not seen it. So this will be a brand new experience for four of us, and one of us it is a beloved-ish or interesting, or can be a lot of different things, movie that they would like to share with the rest of us. So with that in mind, Andy, tell us why you picked The Man Who Would Be King, what it means to you, and why you are having us watch this.
I'm good, thanks. Wait.
Nailed it.
Nailed it in one. The Man Who Would Be King is a movie that is near and dear to my heart, largely because my father introduced it to me, gosh, I don't know when. I was probably in junior high. But even going farther back, I have a lot of fond memories of my dad reading Rudyard Kipling stories to me as a kid. Jungle Book, Puck of Pook's Hill, a lot of stories like that that just, you know, so it has a lot of very fond memories in my mind. And I can tell after having seen this movie so many times now and as an adult, you know, I can tell that my dad must have been very excited to show this to me, knowing that I had a taste for those kind of stories anyway. So this has been, yeah, this has been one I've owned on DVD for a long time. I've watched it, I don't know how many times, but it's one that I always really, really enjoy. And I'm excited for you guys to see it.
Nice. And did you say that you kind of went back and forth with him talking about kind of remembering it together?
Yeah, well, I wanted to make sure that my dad actually introduced me to this because I wasn't quite sure. But I did confirm it was my dad. Yes.
Nice.
And good. he was very excited for me. So he's going to hopefully listen to this episode when it comes out. Hi, Dad.
Nice. Right on. We always enjoy parental listens. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
Nice. Cool. Well, so we have confirmed that none of the rest of us have seen this. Does anybody have any awareness of it? I know we've talked a little bit about it as a group. I think mostly just the casting, that it's Sean Connery and Michael Caine. That's about the extent of my seeing it. I remember, Andy, you showed this at your house on Laurel where you and Rogie and Mark lived.
I didn't even know that he showed it at the house where I lived.
Really? Weird. Very odd. So I remember seeing a little bit of it, but I didn't see the whole thing. And there's sort of a meme picture of Sean Connery in the world now, as there often will be, I guess, of him in like this kind of like Speedo thong thing. And I can't remember what it's from. Amen. It's from him.
It's from Zardoz.
Zardoz. Good call. That's it. So uh-huh. I kind of picture that when I think of The Man Who Would Be King, because I mean, you know, If I picture Sean Connery as a king, it's basically that. So basically, that's the extent of my knowledge of it. One being who's in it. I know that to be true. And two being an image that is not at all related to it. So it's entirely false.
Although you do get to see Sean Connery's ass in this movie.
That's true. That's interesting.
That's true.
Interesting. All right. Well, I've got that to look forward to.
And Kyle, anybody else? I love that your entire like preconception of this film was based on a false association.
Thank you. I'm just honest about what I bring to the show here. I'm just throwing it out there.
Mine's probably the same, because every time we say the title or I hear the title, I think the Once and Future King, which is about King Arthur.
Yeah, that's totally
so
different.
I'm assuming that this movie, because it has Sean Connery and Michael Caine, and they, especially back in the 60s and 70s, did a lot of movies about the Middle Ages and King Lionheart and whatever else. So I'm assuming it's about King Arthur. Am I right, Andy?
Well, Sean Connery did play King Richard in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. So yeah,
I was just going to say
you're
that.
Pretty much right.
So, but am I right about this movie being about King Arthur?
Yes, Jared. Okay.
I can't wait.
Well, then it's weird that he played King Arthur again in First Knight.
Hmm. N-I-G-H-T?
K-N-I-G-H-T.
Got it.
Well, it's like Rex Harrison playing the same character in the stage and film versions of My Fair Lady.
But yes. Different.
But not at all.
And he played King Richard in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, or did we already mention that?
Yes. Keep up, Jer.
You
keep
said up. Prince of Thieves, and I heard Men in Tights. So I'm all over the place tonight.
But you were thinking of Patrick Stewart.
Which is Patrick Stewart.
Well, on that note, let us move along. Let's actually watch the damn movie.
This is going to be the most hilarious movie ever.
let's watch the damn movie, see what it actually is, and then when
it's
we
Nick
come
Nolte
back
and Prince
here,
of Tides.
Oh, God. That's the worst of all. And when we come back here, we will all have seen it, and we'll actually be able to talk about it in a fun, informed way. So, on with the show.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby and buy ourselves a snack.
All right, and we are back. So now we all have seen The Man Who Would Be King. If I remember correctly, we were talking about whether this was King Arthur, King Richard, Robin Hood, Men in Tights, Prince of Thieves. And luckily for all of us, it was all of those things. It was all kings and all archers. It was a big ass movie. So again, we are discussing The Man Who Would Be King, Andy's pick. Andy, before we dive into it, how did your rewatching it feel to you? Did it feel any different this go around?
It felt good. Felt good. Felt like revisiting an old friend. I hadn't seen it in a while. I realized in watching it that, and I think a lot of us agreed on this by looking at some of the notes that we took, that the third act of the movie happens a lot quicker than I remember.
Okay.
Compared to the first and second acts.
Okay.
But yeah, I really just enjoyed this movie.
Got it. Cool. What about everybody else? We'll do our rating at the end here, but was it a positive impression, negative, meh, somewhere in between?
It was much more adventure-y than I was expecting.
Yeah?
I didn't necessarily like either Michael Caine or Sean Connery's characters because they weren't very likable people, but at the same time, I liked the background and the setup for everything. And you could tell, and you could very much feel that this is a Rudyard Kipling story, full of adventure and, treasure or whatever. I mean, it wasn't necessarily treasure, but it was these guys trying to loot this village or whatever. But you could tell it was that type of story.
Yeah. But there was treasure. I mean, there was literal treasure.
There was. But yeah, I liked the setting for it and how adventure-y it felt.
Yeah, agreed. Well, sort of speaking along those lines, we just did a little note-taking here. And the first thing that we wanted to talk about here is just the epic scale of it. So as I said in the intro, this is, in fact, a big-ass movie. I like that, you know, I very much appreciate the Game of Thrones. I'm not sorry, Game of Thrones, the Lord of the Rings, you know, swarms of armies, tens of thousands of people. But they're all CG. Like, I like that they can do that now. I think that's really cool. I think the effect is really neat. But man, I like when there's like hundreds or thousands of people, and you know, they're like, all right, we need 1,000 people that look Afghani or Indian or what have you, and we need them all right here at 5 o'clock on Saturday. You know what I mean? Like, I appreciate that. You know, it makes me realize like the amount of work that goes into that, and that's pretty rad. What else did you guys think on the epic side of it? It definitely was a big story, and it went all over the place.
I made a note about how much I enjoyed the what I described as the authenticity of this film, and that it just looked real, it looked genuine. The costumes, the cast members, the extras all looked as if they were truly plucked out of the Indian subcontinent or Afghanistan and dropped onto a movie set. Although then in doing a little research on this movie, I see that it was actually filmed mostly in France and Morocco, yeah. But still, I digress.
Well, that just means they did a really good job.
They did a really good job, location scouting. But I like the, you know, speaking of the grandeur of it, I like the vast swaths of locales that this is filmed in, from subtropical India to the, you know, the Khyber Pass and the peaks of these deadly mountains into the land beyond. It really shows you an interesting slice of what the world looked like over there, and how these two characters, how Peachy and Daniel, that were played by Michael Caine and Sean Connery, proved to be so resourceful in dealing with all these different situations. You know, Jared talked about how these characters aren't really likable, and I could see that. I disagreed a little bit. I thought they were very roguish and fun. However, you can see they definitely had, you know, they had their shadier side to the dealing with the world, but they were also incredibly versatile and handy in dealing with the world. They'd seen a lot of it and knew how to interact with it to exploit it to their own advantage. And they were able to take those skills and apply them to a huge swath of land and a huge diverse group of people. So I thought that was very, very fun to watch.
I almost felt like a couple of the situations, like when they were basically in, like, I mean, I don't even know what to call it, whatever the Indian version of blackface is, and they were trying to kind of find their way to where they were going. Like, a couple of those times, it felt too easy, almost. Like, yeah. they should have stuck out a lot more than they did. So I feel like it's very rare that I wish a movie was longer, but this is one that I really think, and we'll talk about some pacing issues in a little bit here, but really, I feel like it could have been a chance for it to be fleshed out a little bit more. A couple of those scenes just felt so fast, you know, like them kind of getting there. But then, like, the scene when they were in the, we'll get to the pacing thing. I'll come back to that. But, you know, that's my only criticism of that, was that there were some things where it was just felt like it relied too much on their charisma, and it really shouldn't have worked. Mm-hmm. And I buy that it did, but it was just a little bit tough. It took me out of that just a little bit.
Yeah, I agree. I think being able to flesh that out a little more and give maybe some context to what was going on would have been helpful.
Yeah, I went back and forth on how many of those scenes were really needed. And the scene that stuck out to me in particular was when they were on the road. They had not yet gone up into the Himalayas, and they were set upon by some banditos when they were that's totally an inappropriate word, but, you know, when they were camping, basically. And they basically outsmarted them and then, you know, drove them off. Do we really care about that scene, or is it just, like, how much does it lend to their characters? How much does it lend to the setting of it being dangerous and them being resourceful? I don't know. I felt that, like, it contributed 2 minutes that I didn't really care about.
Yeah.
I would disagree a little bit, but I can see why you'd say that. To me, it felt like it was a bit, it was like a long scene in a traveling montage. And that whole stretch of the film was like a really long traveling montage to me. Where they go down the river, they have to float down the river, then they encounter those Afghans and steal their mules and then climb up into the mountains. It is a long stretch of the movie, but I personally enjoyed that aspect of the length and treachery of the journey that they went on, that they undertook.
Yeah, I could see that.
That's just me.
It's interesting thinking of it as a montage, because it felt sort of awkwardly between a montage and a fully fleshed out character driven thing, you know, like it could, like we said, it could have gone shorter, it could have been more tight, or it could have gone longer and we would have had more character building opportunities, more chances for them to kind of demonstrate that they have the skills as opposed to just like doing it, you know? So yeah, that's interesting. It didn't keep me from enjoying it, but it just felt a little weird, a little easy for me. I have to say the sets of this were really good. We talked about how legitimate it felt, and it kind of had that older epic films, whether they mean to or not, like the really good ones, they shouldn't feel this way, but they feel almost exploitative, because you're like, I wonder how much the people that were there got paid. Like, were these people that just lived there that showed up? Like, how taken advantage of was this community and people and what have you? So a lot of classic epic films like that, I've had the kind of ooky feeling about this, and this triggered that too. But admittedly, it was not filmed where it was set. So they had to recreate that. They had to bring in people. So my hope is that it was, you know, legit, but you just never quite know.
I think the production design was my favorite part of the movie, just because I can appreciate that, you know, how much work had to have gone into trying to, you know, organize that many extras.
Yeah.
And those kinds of sets. I mean, there were no special effects. You know, there was no such thing as CGI, and I didn't sense that they used any backdrops or anything like that. So
it seemed pretty genuine. I think they did film at a movie studio for part of it, Mm-hmm. So maybe some of the
probably the interiors.
Like maybe some of the interiors, or maybe the a couple of the scenes at the beginning in like the Indian bazaars or something like that.
Yeah.
Maybe that were a little more enclosed, but still it was, yeah, I agree with you, Lee. I thought the production design was fantastic.
Yeah.
I got the sense they used a couple of composites during the Himalaya scenes.
Yeah, yeah, probably.
Makes sense.
It felt to me that like this was sort of a movie that bridged the gap between, not intentionally, but this was sort of that middle point between old movies like Spartacus and those big giant epic movies with huge casts of extras, and then into movies, and this is a bad example, but movies like Indiana Jones, where it's, you still have the spectacle of it and these great locations. And
I think it's a good example.
And yeah, large cast, but lots of extras that made it feel authentic, but a smaller scale movie. And I think this is sort of halfway between those two.
Yeah, that's a really good point. It's like, not Lawrence of Arabia and it's not Indy. It's really in between there in every way.
It's
and in mostly good ways.
Yeah.
Yes.
What were you going to say?
Jerry, I think you have a very good point, because the Indiana Joneses of the world are very character driven in focusing on a very specific story, where I think this is more story driven with some interesting characters. That's yet on a smaller scale than your Lawrence of Arabia's or your Spartacus. those kinds of things. So yeah, I think that's a good continuum that you described there.
I do what I can.
One thing that I had a little bit of a hard time with was, you know, as an epic, it goes all over the place. And I think that can often happen with epic movies where they have to cover so much ground that the tone can fluctuate. And I really feel like this one did that as well. There were a lot of differences in the beginning versus the end. And we'll talk about kind of the third act. In fact, let's do it now. Let's talk about that. The ending of the movie happened very quickly. It went from sort of, you know, I don't know if swashbuckling is the right word, but like, you know, adventure film with two buddies to or they're being out of place and then trying to make themselves, you know, sort of play off that they are meant to be there and be these people that they're not. And then all of a sudden it made a turn, and I can't decide if it did it in a way that should be commended, because I was like, whoa, okay, this is where it's going. All right. I had no idea to expect that, which is really exciting, but I kind of felt it was either so abrupt that it was great or so abrupt that it was bad, and I can't decide which. You know what I mean? What do you guys think?
I thought that it was too abrupt.
Yeah.
I just, you know, when the two of them start like arguing towards the end and disagreeing on a few things, I felt like that disagreement should have played out longer, but at the same time, I haven't read the book, so I don't know what, I wasn't familiar with the story at all, but I almost felt like that should have been played out longer, and it would have made the ending, I don't know, maybe a little bit more tragic.
Yeah, I would agree. It felt like their conflict didn't really amount to anything.
No.
I think the span of time, because I think in the book, if I did my Wikipedia research correctly, that Dravet is king for like a span of months. And I didn't get that sense that it was all that clear in the movie how long he had been kind of established on the throne.
Yeah.
And I feel like that could have been made a little clearer to establish that his position as king was becoming a little more solidified, and that maybe Peachy's role was becoming a little more muddled, where he was kind of, you know, he's the general of all the armies, but you know, you could tell that that was where you got a little sense of that when Daniel was saying things like, you know, for the sake of appearances, I'd like you to bow before me like everyone else, that kind of a thing. You could tell that he's starting to believe the illusion.
Yeah. Kiss a little my bit. Royal ash.
Yeah. good job, voice actor.
No, that's terrible. That's bad.
It's okay. We'll workshop it.
And so that period of time, or somehow establishing that kind of getting settled into a level of comfort that maybe was a false sense of security. You're building up some of that tension so that, to me, I made a comment in the notes that it felt like the third act happened. I felt like I could see, and probably because I've seen this movie so many times, obviously I knew what was coming, but there was the storm clouds off in the distance after Daniel becomes king, and all of a sudden you can see them, you kind of see this foreboding that something bad's going to happen, then all of a sudden, boom, it's right here. And it that from the distance to right now happened a lot faster than maybe what we were expecting. And I think it was jarring to a certain degree. I kind of liked that jarring aspect of it. Like, so, you know, this is how quickly he could be wrenched out of his position of his seat of comfort and power to, you know, to being hunted down and executed essentially. But yeah, it was, there was something about that that I felt was missing.
Yeah. I do feel like that, that quick turn is definitely realistic, but dramatically it could have been more effective just to dwell on it a little bit more.
Yeah,
you know, because as it is, they seeing thunderclouds off in the distance, and then all of a sudden it's raining when I'm trying to ride my bike home from work. You know, that's pretty real, and that's that happens to me like once a week. But it could have been played up more to good dramatic effect in this film.
You know, one thing I never thought about until I was just kind of, putting my brain to it right now is that I don't remember, and maybe you guys can correct me, did they decide who was going to kind of be the leader once they got there? I mean, was Connery predestined to be the god?
That was because he got hit by the arrow in that first battle.
Right, that's what I'm saying, is that they never decided that.
No, so the people decided it, essentially.
Right, so that was thrust upon. So Michael Caine, it was not clear to him who was going to be the leader, like, and I don't think that they... they co-led that whole thing. They were truly in it together, and to not have a discussion about how that goes, I think they could have done more a little bit to show him as someone who has been not wronged, but who didn't have a choice in the matter. All of a sudden he has to be the other guy.
No, it's a good point.
They never got a chance to talk about that, to discuss it, to decide how it was going to be. It just happened.
They did though. And I do feel like that there's definitely something to that. That when they're describing their plan to Kipling, I think they just say like, we will be kings, and they're right. Talking about basically that they will be this much more sophisticated than the savages out there, that they would both be they essentially co-rulers. But I feel like they hadn't really thought about it. And then there is the scene. Once Dravet is shot by the arrow and all the natives believe that he's a god, there's a scene where Peachy basically convinces him to go with it.
Yeah, this is true. You can tell he's very opportunistic in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good call. I forgot about that scene.
Before we move on to another point, speaking of the ending, Sean Connery's death scene, anyone?
I like the sing-along. It was pretty badass.
That trumpet solo, man, gets me right every time I hear that. That slow intro to that hymn. Oh, right in the heart, right in the cockles.
The subcockle region.
Yeah, man. No, I think I love that scene. I think that, I think one of my favorite parts of that scene is like the waver and the crack in Michael Caine's voice as he tries to sing along.
Yeah.
That is just like, oh.
And finishing the song.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, I had qualms with the 4 minutes prior to that, the kind of the big shootout, but the actual like the end was quite good.
But do they build really nice fancy vine bridges just for human sacrifices to the chasm gods or whatever? Like,
no, they mentioned.
I feel like it's a big waste of vine rope.
It is.
Yeah, it was all investing in the delicious irony that that Dravet had that bridge built. In his rule as king,
ooh, yeah, he is delicious.
He does. Whoa. It as essentially, it's like bridging the river Kwai. It was a task to keep the army busy when they ran out of enemies to fight.
Huh, I did not know that.
Yeah, they mentioned it just kind of briefly in passing.
And then Michael Caine should have said, "This is madness."
Do it, Mark.
I'm sure
he
did.
Madness.
There it is.
Nice. Speaking of madness, huh? Huh? This movie was, colonialism at its best / worst. This was certainly, again, kind of going back to that exploitative piece. This was not a sensitive film in that regard, but I didn't feel like it was flagrant in any way. I mean, the attitude was such that, like you said, Andy, like these savages won't know any better, right? So, I mean, that's rough. But, I mean, what do you guys think? Especially if we were talking about, like, really, we're not talking about a remake here, but we would certainly probably do that a little bit differently now. But it seemed to be an accurate reflection of the time.
Yeah, I think that's enough. It doesn't need to get any more offensive than that to say that, you know, these people came in with the attitude like, oh yeah, these people are ripe for exploitation. This is a brilliant idea. And yes, it's honest. It's super honest. And, you know, for a period piece, it does need to be that. But yeah, just reflecting on how, on what big jerks we all were as humans.
Yeah. All right. And then to close out here, let's talk a little bit about the performances. So there are two big names here, Sean Connery and Michael Caine. And then a third one, Christopher Plummer as Kipling himself, whom I did not recognize at all. I haven't seen a lot of Christopher Plummer, but I've seen enough to know what he looks like. And he was completely unrecognizable to me. So I want to give him and his makeup crew a shout out for that. That was very good.
And kudos that you actually looked quite a lot like Rudyard Kipling if you look up a picture of him. It looked quite a bit like what Christopher Plummer looked like in that movie.
Cool. Nice. Yeah, he was not in it a lot, but I enjoyed his performance. You know, he's kind of certainly the third bill, but I liked him.
Yeah, he was great. I think he was unrecognizable as Christopher Plummer because he didn't bring that bravado that his roles usually have.
Yeah. Yeah, good point.
It was very understated. It was a very, and I want to say meek, but very unlike a lot of other Christopher Plummer roles.
Well, isn't he essentially the unbiased narrator in the book? I mean,
yeah, the book is an unnamed British journalist who a lot of people just assumed it was Kipling kind of writing in the first person.
Yeah.
So instead of Peachy being the narrator as he was in the movie, in the book it's really the Kipling's unnamed character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I kept waiting for them to take advantage of him in some way, shape, or form, and they never really did. Like, I think they just saw him as an equal. The whole Mason thing was kind of weird. Yeah, boy, this movie could be like I don't know what Battlefield Earth is to Scientology. Thankfully, this is a much better movie than Battlefield Earth. But like, yeah, this is kind of an advertisement for Masons.
Well, it is, but at the same time, there's a lot of. I don't know if I want to necessarily call them historical facts, but there's a lot of truth to what they were saying in terms of the history of the Masons. Yeah, I mean, it's they do talk about it quite a bit, but and whether, you know, who know whether there would be this ancient stone with the exact replica of the Masonry symbol on it. Unlikely. But
yeah,
the Masons go back a long, long, long time.
Yeah.
Unlike L. Ron Hubbard.
Fair, very fair. So now then that brings us to the other two. So Andy, given this is your film, why don't you tell us about your impressions of the two, if you liked them better, if you have any preference in
sure.
the two?
Sure. I'll talk about Sean Connery first. Well, to lump both characters together of Daniel and Peachy, I like that they're both these non-commissioned officer soldier, career soldier / mercenary / you know, entrepreneurs / con men, but very, very working class, never had anything handed to them, but they approach it differently. And Connery being Connery kind of plays it as a big blustering person. And I haven't read the book, so I can't speak if this is an accurate description of the book, but I like his portrayal. They're kind of two sides of the same coin a little bit, that he uses his bombast a little bit to his own advantage, and he still has a little bit of charm to him, but he doesn't play the, you know, the James Bond level of charm. He's a lot more, I don't know, down to earth and a little bit silly at times. And then Michael Caine, in my opinion, was my favorite. He was my favorite part of this movie. I loved his character. I loved the character of Peachy, that he was, you could tell that he and Daniel were devoted to each other. Daniel especially was kind of a jokester and a trickster. But also he was very smart, and I got the impression in watching the interplay between those two that he was perhaps the brains of the operation. He seemed to be able to see consequences a few steps down the road a little easier than Daniel did. He recognized very quickly when, you know, like the dangers of Daniel wanting to take a wife, the dangers of going to see the high priest, the dangers of you know, the jig being up, so to speak. But at the same time, through all that, he was loyal. He was fair. He was always, you know, true to Daniel to the end. And I loved his portrayal. I know there was some criticism of his role, of Michael Caine's performance originally, and when this movie came out in 1975. And it is kind of brassy and over the top, maybe a little bit. But I don't know. I just really, really liked it. Kane at his most Kanean.
Yeah, and I mean, when you're going up against Connery, like, everything that Connery does feels big because of that voice, you know?
But yeah.
It's both booming and it's Connery. I mean, it's just his thing. So, like, I think anybody else could cower next to it if you don't go big. So I never felt like he was really overblown or overacting or anything. It felt true to form for me.
And I love that even in the 70s, Michael Caine sounds like Michael Caine, the butler for Batman. Mm-hmm. Like, his voice just never changes.
Alfred Pennyworth.
It makes me want to go back and watch the soccer movie. What the heck was it? Not Glory.
Ladybugs.
No.
Invictus.
No. This is terrible.
Bend it like Beckham.
No. Shut up, everyone.
I'm naming soccer movies.
It's Sylvester Stallone and Michael Caine in a soccer movie.
What?
That takes place. Maybe I should just make it a.
Is this a
they were
gem?
In a they were in a maybe, movie together?
Maybe I should just make this my next Remaker's Mark pick because it's ripe for remake.
Yeah, I got nothing. I have no idea what that is.
I've never heard of that.
But anyway, Michael Caine, it's a very old, it's an older movie, and Michael Caine is a very young Michael Caine. He plays a soccer player, he plays a guy in the military who also plays soccer. But it's just the same, like, he's got the same little to his voice he's got now. And, like, it's Michael Caine. He's Michael Caine. And that's one of my favorite things about Michael Caine is that he's always Michael Caine.
There's Dells. I want you to find. I want you to insert, if I can find it, a clip from the movie The Trip with Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, where they're doing the accents.
And they're doing the Michael Caine impression.
Yeah.
Over the years.
Yep.
It's so good. It needs to go in right now.
All right.
I say Michael Caine used to talk like this in the 1960s, right? But that has changed. And I say that over the years, Michael's voice has come down several. Octave, let me finish. And all of the cigars and the brandy, don't let me finish, can now be heard.
Okay.
I've not finished in the back of the voice. And the voice now. Well, I've still not finished the voice.
Well, you're panicking.
Like you're about to bloody talk. Let me finish. Right, so Michael Caine's voice now in the Batman movies and in Harry Brown. I can't go fast because Michael Caine talks very, very slowly.
Right, this is how Michael Caine speaks. Michael Caine speaks to his nose like that. He gets very, very specific. It's very like that. When he gets loudly, it gets very loud indeed. It gets very specific. It's not quite nasal enough the way you're doing it, all right? You're not doing it the way he speaks. You're not doing it with the kind of... And you don't do the broken voice when he gets very emotional. But he gets very emotional indeed. She was only 16 years old. She was only 16. You're only supposed to blow the bloody doors off. That's Michael Caine.
And done.
Sweet.
Good work. Yeah. I thought Connery was good. You know, again, I had some scruples with the turn, but it was not with his performance of it. I actually thought he did quite well with that. I thought he sold it well. But yeah, it was very much Michael Caine's movie for me. Lee, Mark, how about you? Anything on your side?
I bought it all the way down through the bill. I didn't think that any performances were out of place, certainly. I mean, the whole film felt like the product of its era.
Yeah.
But I didn't think anything was out of place.
Yeah, well put. I like that. A product of its era.
Yeah, I thought it was okay. It was, the pacing was a little strange for me, but again, I wasn't familiar with the story at all. I hadn't read the book, so I'm just wondering if that would have helped. But I don't know. I thought the performances were good. Felt a little bit like Spies Like Us, but not funny.
That's awesome.
I just got a sense of like that kind of, it was almost like that kind of buddy movie, but not,
yeah.
You know?
Totally. Well, and it could have been. There were a couple scenes in there, like when they were kind of in the market and, you know, like I said, they had face makeup on or whatever, that had that vibe of like,
yeah.
What is going on here?
I wonder if the writers of Spies Like Us kind of pulled from a movie like this.
That would be awesome. But, yeah. I wouldn't not say it.
Yeah.
That's for sure. All right, so now let's do our rating of it. Let's go around the horn here. So we'll do a 1 to 10 scale of your choosing. So Andy, what would be your rating on a 1 to 10, 10 being the best?
And I will say again, this has a lot of emotional worth to me. So take that for what it will. Take that for what it is. I give this 9 out of 10 utas.
Ooh, nice. I like that. Jer, how about you? What would your rating be?
I would give this 6.5 rope bridges.
Nice. All right. I like
it. And tumbling Sean Connery dolls.
That's a good one. That's a good one. Lee, how about you? What would your rating be?
I will give it 6 out of 10 bandoliers.
Nice. Good use of bandolier. Appreciate that. The Chewbacca fan in me is a huge fan of that.
Yeah.
Mark, how about you? What's your rating?
I'm going to give this one 7.5 out of 10 sheepskin balloon rafts.
Ooh, nice.
Nice. That was a good scene. I forgot about that. Yeah. I like that. Nice.
I did good like, work. Just as a quick aside, I liked all the little stories they told about their soldiering days. Like, those are just nice little bits of color and context.
Yeah.
That were just, they were just funny.
Yeah.
Plus, you get to listen to Michael Caine laugh so hard he starts an avalanche.
That's true. Although it does end up with that random other character that they run into, you know, not the infantryman, the guy that runs off with the sword at the end. I can't remember his character's
Billy
name.
Billy Fish.
Billy, right?
Billy, yeah, yeah.
Oh, that, Billy.
I thought that one was a little weird, same kind of thing where I was like, all right, I guess I'll buy it. Yeah. My rating would be, I'm going to give it a 7, 7.5. I don't know how you half a Freemason, but I give it 7.5 Freemasons. It's usually not suggested, but what can you do?
I think you ended up with a couple of half Freemasons at the end of the film.
Yes, this is true. This is true.
I picked the half that's still in the bottom of the crevice, or the crevasse, if you will.
Ooh.
Ooh, harsh. All right, well, that wraps us up here for the first of our Hidden Gem series. I'm excited to move along with this. The next of our Hidden Gem series is Jer's pick of The Brotherhood of the Wolf. But before that, we will be doing Gone with the Wind for our next Remakers Mark pick. So if we start watching right now, it'll probably be done shortly before it publishes. And it will be good. So I'm excited about that. Gentlemen, this was a really good time. Thanks for hanging out. I would go on any kind of adventure with you involving avalanches and beheadings and all that fun stuff, though I would rather not be beheaded. So until the next time we hang out, sans beheading, may the force be with you.
And also with you.
I thought it was really weird that they brought he brought his head out at the end.
I was not
yeah. expecting that at all.
And just yeah. left
and
it
then
for...
just and then just left and went crazy.
left it for Kipling.
Yep.
It was a thank you for the cigar that he took earlier.
Yeah. Have a crown that the head is still attached to.
I told you I'd bring you a souvenir from Kafiristan.
They were out of air fresheners.
I'm going to stop recording now.
Yes, yep. Yes indeed.